From our nation's capital, this is Naps Chat.
I'm gonna sit right down and write myself a letter and make believe it came from you.
Hi, and welcome to this week's episode of Naps Chat. I'm Bob Levy, the Director of Legislative and Political Affairs for the National Association of Postal Supervisors. This episode's focus will be the celebration of our nation's 250th anniversary of when the original 13 American colonies declare their independence from Great Britain. With me to discuss the role of the blossoming United States postal operation at the time of our independence are two historians from the United States Postal Service, USPS historian and returning guest Stephen Kochsberger and June Marie Brandt, senior research analyst for postal history at the U.S. Postal Service. Both are former postmasters from Pennsylvania. Both have worked in the historian's office for over a decade, and both have long careers at the Postal Service. Welcome to Naps Chat, Stephen, June Marie.
Hi, Bob. We're glad to be here.
Morning, Bob.
Let's get started. At the very beginning, what was the difference between postal operations under the British Crown versus operations made when the USA created its own postal entity?
There was really very little difference. Franklin kept the British model, and he basically just changed how it was administered. It was the same jobs, the same jargon, postmaster general and controller and surveyor. So he kept a lot. We basically just changed the framework. Of course, there had been some attempts earlier, like in 1774 with William Goddard's constitutional post, as people kind of realized that as they had more subversive ideas, you couldn't trust the Royal Mail. But it was working well. Franklin had run it for some years, so he kind of kept with what he knew and kept it the same.
So, June Marie, the Postal Service created subversion of the British Crown.
Yes, it did.
Or if it didn't create, it conveyed it.
Mm-hmm. Yes, definitely.
Now, let's dig a little deeper. The postal system was quite different then than what it is now. So let's talk about the mail mix.
Well,
what was the mail mix like in 1776?
Officially, it was all letters. Newspapers were conveyed by the post riders, but they were not considered mail.
What were they considered?
They were considered newspapers, but they were just kind of contracted with the post rider how much you were going to pay to have it taken to the next town or along the route.
Not until 1792, under the Postal Act, were newspapers actually considered to be entered into the mail stream.
Is that somewhat odd? Because a lot of the postmasters at the time of our independence were actually publishers of newspapers.
It was a great business opportunity. If you published a newspaper to be the postmaster, you could make sure your papers got delivered.
And Ben Franklin was a publisher of a newspaper?
Absolutely. The Pennsylvania Gazette and many of his colleagues were also newspaper publishers.
Did they compete against each other?
Well, newspapers were hyper-local, so the competition, there was local competition. In fact, Franklin got his position because the previous postmaster printed a rival newspaper, refused to allow Franklin to send his papers through the mail, and he complained and got the job himself.
Now, let's go back to our letters, which are really the mail. How much did it cost to send an item through the 13 states or colonies in 1776?
Well, it was a little bit complicated. There was no flat rate. Franklin had a rate chart that was dependent on distance and the number of sheets in the letter. He also had a separate rate for expresses. So he determined that you had a big chart. You had to go along from city to city, almost like the old road map. Calculating distance, and you went down, and it was measured in penny weight and grains of silver. Another complication with it was that each colony had their own currency. You'll read in Franklin's journal, he'll say, in Pennsylvania currency and New York currency. But yeah, it got very complicated, especially if you were going further distance, and like, for instance, what he called double letters and treble letters that basically doubled the rate or tripled the rate.
So let me clarify this. unlike now, when there's a uniform rate of postage, whether or not you send a letter from Philadelphia to Anchorage, Alaska, at the time of the colonies, it was different whether or not you sent a letter from Boston to Philadelphia or Boston to Williamsburg.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You had to figure it out on the chart and go down, and it would show you how many pennyweight and how many extra grains of silver you had to pay for that letter.
Wow. That is a far cry change, and it really sort of forces us to consider the issue of the universal service obligation as we understand it today.
And that sort of rate structure stayed in place probably until the 1850s. It was still a distance based. The other interesting thing is that envelopes were not used to mail letters. You would write your letter and then fold it up and put the address on the outside, seal it with wax.
And where did you put the stamp?
There were no stamps until 1845. The postmaster would just write the postage rating on it, and you did not pay to send the letter. You paid to get the letter.
Did that increase the value of mail or decrease the value of mail?
Well, if you were going to pay to get it, it must have been something worth something to you.
And if you couldn't be bothered to pay for it, you obviously didn't really need that mail that much.
But you will see the newspapers from the time the postmasters would place monthly ads listing the names of people who had mail to be picked up at the post office.
The way in which the post, and you alluded to this, Jew Marie, that the organization of the postal system in 1776 was quite different than we understand the organization of our postal operation today. Could you talk about how it was organized in 1776?
Well, the Postmaster General was, of course, the head, and all the what we now call local postmasters were called deputy postmasters, and they reported to the Postmaster General. Then also the post riders were contracted, and they were paid by contract to go between towns and give the mail to and from the postmasters who they gave it to. So it was a lot simpler in some ways, but in other ways complex, because each post rider had to have his own contract.
The Postmaster General himself was dealing directly with the postmasters, unlike today where there's many intermediate steps of administration. But there was only about 70 post offices in 1776, so the task was simplified because it was a smaller organization.
Where were the post offices located?
All along the East Coast, from Maine down to Charleston was, I believe, the most southern point.
And, actually, Savannah, Georgia.
I'm sorry, Savannah, Georgia. And the once furthest west was Winchester, Virginia. And Winchester, along with York, Pennsylvania, and Lancaster, Pennsylvania, were considered the frontier. They were the kind of unknown wild frontier there and the Wild West of its day. But for the most part, it was along the East Coast, along the King's Highway, which became the Post Road, which is pretty much today's Route 1.
Physical location of a post office. Were they in these physical structures that we currently understand as a post office, or where were they located?
No, there were no freestanding post offices. They were usually located either in a local tavern or in a bigger city with the printer of a newspaper, with a printer or publisher. But yeah, they were not freestanding. They were always incorporated with some other type of business. And they kind of took that on for the extra money, I guess you'd say, for a little bit more traffic and more business.
Right. So being a postmaster was not a full-time position. It was a little extra on top of whatever your other business was.
Did you have postmasters who were tavern keepers?
Absolutely.
And you picked up your mail in the tavern.
That's right.
And you had a drink in the tavern.
Yes.
Perhaps.
That incentivized delivery pickup.
Correct.
Early delivery pickup.
Sort of like the convenience stores of the Revolutionary period.
When the post offices were situated, did they have anything known as like a post office box? Or how was the mail or the letters held by in within these taverns or postal operations in 1776?
There was no formalized system. Post office boxes did not come into use. Generally, the postmaster would have a section of his business set aside strictly for postal use, and he may have a shelf and he may even put the letters in alphabetical order. They had to be kept secure. Other than that, there was really no official way of handling the mail in the post office.
In 1776, was there anything known, or predating 1776 under the Crown Post, anything known as like a universal service obligation or that the right of everyone to get mail?
Absolutely not. It was, again, in the towns and cities, and probably I would say for those who had a little bit of means, because, you know, sending a letter was expensive. Normal everyday people, for the most part, could not afford it. So it was used for important business and diplomatic business. And, of course, you know, as people started thinking more revolutionary ideas. But there was no, you know, the vast majority, even at that time, of where Americans were settling was not covered by the post office. There was no service to those areas.
So it was primarily commercial correspondence and periodicals that used the postal system?
Under the Crown, it was commerce and government administration. That was the main purpose. The Queen Anne's Act of Parliament in 1710 that created the Postal Service in North America explicitly said it was to raise revenue for Her Majesty.
We read so much, and I know we've spoken about this before, Steve. Abigail Adams and John Adams had a lot of correspondence between each other, particularly during the early part when they were voting on a Declaration of Independence. How was their letters conveyed, if not for a post rider?
They used a variety of methods. Paul Revere carried letters back and forth between Boston and Philadelphia. When the Continental Congress was meeting, he made numerous trips, 350 miles on horseback to bring letters. John Adams at one point writes that Mr. Revere brought some letters today from my bride, and it was the happiest day of his life.
So can we say that Paul Revere might have been one of the earliest letter carriers in the United States?
I think that would be oversimplifying
it. Yeah, he was, because I don't know if he was officially taking them. I think it might have been more as a favor to the Adamses and others.
Officially, he was an express rider, which is different than a post rider. Right. A post rider is someone who carries mail on a fixed route to multiple pieces of mail, you know, to a post office. An express rider may just take a single letter to one person.
Now, how were post riders, and express riders for that matter, compensated in 1776?
They would work out a contract with the postmaster, and we have one, for instance, from 1801 showing the rates between a couple towns for the post rider, and it was $85 he was paid between Falmouth and, where was he going, Steve?
Gloucester,
and that was just, yeah, he was paid that for the year, I believe.
Right.
So, yeah, you would work out a contract between two towns, you know, sometimes multiple towns, but, yeah, it was all worked out separately. So you might not be getting the same. For instance, somebody in one area might be getting paid more than somebody in the south, and the frequency mattered also. You would contract for the frequency. For instance, Mary Catherine Goddard would receive 4 dispatches a week, 2 coming from the north, 2 coming from the south. And she was the postmaster of Baltimore, so she was kind of central. And that was fairly typical of the contract she would set up. So she got four dispatches a week, probably maybe New York. You got definitely more multiple deliveries. Also in Boston, Boston or Philadelphia, you'd receive more.
And Mary Catherine Goddard, just to keep the mail moving during the war, if she didn't have enough revenue in the till to pay the carrier, she would dig into her own pocket just to keep the mail moving.
Let me get to that. Postmaster Goddard, were there a lot of female postmasters at that time, or was she the only one?
There are two that we know of in 1776. There was Mary Catherine Goddard in Baltimore and Anne Clay, who was in Newcastle, Delaware.
How many days a week was mail conveyed by a post rider and delivered to a tavern or a post office?
again, it would depend on what your contract was. Some places got mail moved or delivered 7 days a week. Some places, particularly in the South, might get one dispatch a week.
At the extremities of the routes, you know, say in at the northern end of Maine, they may get mail once a week. Savannah, same deal. Those were the two opposite poles of the postal system.
Was mail delivered to some of these outlying islands or offshore islands, like off the coast of Maine or off the coast of Maryland or the and so forth, or they just sort of like would have to come ashore to get their mail?
They would have to go to town to get their mail, to the nearest town that had a postmaster who would hold the mail there for them.
There was a dedicated route that went down the eastern shore of Maryland.
When our post riders, or express riders for that matter, delivered their mail, what types of obstacles did they encounter while conducting their business?
Well, you had bad roads, which were a big problem in some areas. Weather, of course, because you're out exposed to the elements. You had to keep the mail safe and dry, as well as yourself. But also, particularly as the war became more intensive, you faced a risk of being arrested as a spy because, again, you were conveying news and you were not in the military, you were considered a spy. So you also had the risk of highwaymen. They did operate and would steal the mail or see if you had anything else worth taking.
Yeah, the thing to keep in mind is that in the eyes of the British, this was all outlaw. The postmasters, the post riders, they were all breaking the law, and they should be arrested and punished.
I want to dig a little bit deeper into that aspect of it. Our first postmaster, Ben Franklin, in addition to being the first postmaster, he served as a member of the Committee of Secret Correspondence. Can you talk about the role that letters played in early diplomacy? And that goes to international mail, for that matter, and how such letters were conveyed.
When Franklin was in France, it was very difficult to get letters through, and the sensitive nature of the correspondence between Congress, the committees, and Franklin made it really important, especially to, as we tried to enlist the French to support us. So sending mail through the postal system was not the best option. In fact, the United States did not even have an international mail service at that point. The most reliable way of sending those communiques was through a personal contact, someone who you knew was traveling there and could be trusted to take them. And they were a hot commodity. Some of Franklin's correspondence was stolen. Richard Bache describes when they opened the package of letters from Franklin, it was just all blank paper.
And pretty sometimes in this domestically also, that you would, even the fledgling post office, you did not want to trust your important secret correspondence to. You would use a personal courier or rider that you knew was going to that place.
Before the war, the British had what was called a secret office, where all the mail coming from abroad was detoured first before it was delivered. There they would open the letters, they would examine the contents, and then they had a highly trained team of people who could reseal it, or they were good at engraving. But it was an open secret that your mail was getting read, and that was one of the reasons why patriots did not trust using the Royal Mail for their correspondence.
How safe was sending mail through our postal system, the American postal system?
Well, it would depend on, A, if the rider got through, if he was not captured, or he didn't have some type of accident along the way. And also, you know, I'm sure there were times, I know there's a famous, this is a little bit later, but Washington complaining about the post rider basically leaving things at a tavern and then they disappeared. And he was complaining about letters that just were left there with the tavern keeper and somehow they disappeared. So I don't know about totally safe. I think that's why if it was truly, truly the diplomatic or military, you would use a private courier. Although Ebenezer Hazard, who was later Postmaster General, was dispatched basically to follow George Washington's camp around and have the headquarters post office, which is was used for all the military correspondence.
There was a lot of concern about the loyalty of the carriers and the postmasters. They were all required to swear an oath that they had no loyalty for the king. In addition to, you know, we still take an oath today that we're going to defend the Constitution and perform our duties. They also had to denounce the king in their oath.
The First or Second Continental Congress, as they were working through the crafting of the Declaration of Independence, eventually it was printed and it was circulated among the colonies, the 13 colonies, to publicize that in fact happened. And it took probably, you know, there was the vote occurred on July 4th, and it took some time to reach all the colonies. How was the Declaration of Independence transported among the colonies?
Some were sent through the mail, others were carried by military dispatch. It was read publicly in New York just days after it was ratified. George Washington assembled the troops and had it publicly read, and it produced such an excitement that they immediately tore down the statue of King George and melted it down into musket balls.
I think local printers had a lot to do with it. The first copy of the Declaration of Independence that included the names of the signers was published by Mary Catherine Goddard, and she has her name at the bottom there.
The only woman with her name on the Declaration of Independence.
And curiously, sometimes she signed things that she printed as M.K. Goddard. She must have been kind of proud of this because she put her full name, Mary Catherine Goddard.
We know that the first Postmaster General of the United States was Ben Franklin. The second Postmaster General was Richard Bache, his son-in-law.
Right.
How did that transition go?
Well, Franklin was needed in France. He had set everything up and got it moving, so he kind of had to leave early, but he was needed more in France. The diplomatic mission to France was, at that point, much more important. It was basically going to be our lifeline. You know, getting that deal with France was what kept it possible to keep the revolution going. So Franklin trusted Bache, obviously, but he was needed elsewhere, and it was more important that he go to France. And he felt confident that he had set up the system to work and went on his way.
Franklin had complete confidence in Bache. He was married to Franklin's daughter, and they had been involved in business of various sorts. So he had no doubt that Bache was an honest man and would put his best effort into it. The problem was that Congress had no money. Running a postal service was not a profitable venture.
It still isn't.
Still not. It was never intended to be profitable. It's a service. So Bache was struggling with Congress that could seldom agree with itself. And we had incredible inflation, if you can imagine, that the currency was becoming devalued basically overnight. So he had his hands full trying to keep this in the middle of a war, a postal service operating.
Last question. If we take away any lessons of the postal operation in 1776, what do we learn from it and apply to this year, 2026?
I would say that the post office and the mail is still vital to the continued growth and progress of this country, is what I would say. I think it was important then, and I think especially in 1776, it was an important part of our emerging identity as a nation. But I think the same could be said today. Again, it's recognizable, it's everywhere now, and people immediately see the Sonic Eagle and know it's American and know it's the Postal Service. So I think it's important today as an institution as it was in 1776.
I think if we look back in 1775, a year before the Declaration of Independence, when Congress created the Postal Service, everything that followed that would not have been possible without the Postal Service. We could not have had independence, and we could not have become the nation we are without a way of communicating. Today, that's still our our mission, and we perform it. No matter where you live in this country, you're going to get your mail.
Thank you so much. I want to thank Steve Kokesberger and June Marie Brandt, historians at the United States Postal Service, and appreciate them for joining us today on Naps Chat. Thanks, Steve. Thanks, June Marie.
Thank you, Bob.
And I want to thank Naps Chat listeners for logging on. If you enjoy Naps Chat, please subscribe and follow us in the podcast store of your choice. And more important, share Naps Chat with your friends and colleagues. In the meantime, stay safe, stay healthy, and have a great July 4th.
I'm going to sit right down and write myself a letter and make